itself in two. This effect was equivalent to that produced by Joshua's horns at Jericho, or the danger that could be initiated by soldiers marching in lockstep across a suspension bridge. If their beat struck the resonant frequency, the bridge would sway violently and possibly collapse. Thus, soldiers are trained to break stride while walking across bridges to avoid this amazing type of catastrophe. The World's Columbian Exposition, the Scene by Night. Inadequate as words have been found to convey a realizing idea of the beauty and grandeur of the spectacle which the exposition offers by day, they are infinitely less capable of affording the slightest conception of the dazzling spectacle which greets the eye of the visitor by night. Indescribable by language are the electric fountains. One of them, called the Great Geyser, rises to a height of 150 feet above a band of little geysers. By adding rotating colored lights, the effects created are so bewildering, no eye can find the loveliest. Their vagaries of motion so entrancing, no heart can keep its steady beating. W. E. Cameron. On May the 1st, the Chicago World's Fair, or Columbian Exposition, opened. This auspicious occasion came at a paradoxical time for the country, for on the one hand, the United States had announced that it was the new leader in the creation and deployment of new technology. On the other hand, it was embroiled in the Panic of 1893. Simultaneously, and for one exceptional time, the world at large was experiencing universal peace. The Columbian Exposition covered almost 700 acres, had 60,000 exhibitors, and cost $25 million. With 28 million attendees, the Chicago Fair boasted a $2.25 million profit. Whereas the Paris Exposition of 1889 had the stupendous 984-foot-tall Eiffel Tower, the Chicago Fair boasted the Ferris wheel. Revolving on the largest one-piece axle ever forged, the wheel stood 264 feet high and had a seating capacity of over 2,000. Every day, hundreds of thousands of visitors from every corner of the globe streamed into Chicago's White City. The chief architect, Chicagoan Daniel Hudson Burnham, along with the other planners, based their design on a city of waterways, much like Venice, with a court of honor centrally placed to house the major palaces. With wooden facades made to resemble marble, the buildings rivaled even the great stone achievements of the ancient Romans and Greeks. The manufacturers and liberal arts pavilion, more than twice the size of the others, was by far the largest building in the world. Nearly a third of a mile long and well over two football fields wide, the structure covered 30.5 acres and had a seating capacity of 75,000. Abutting Lake Michigan at the far end above the Court of Honor, with columns extended like the arms of a mighty conductor, was the magnificent arch and peristyle. Designed by head sculptor Auguste Saint-Gaudens, this statue depicted a general representing Christopher Columbus thunderously entering the fair with his mighty team of horses. Beneath this quadriga was the great gilded 65-foot statue of the Republic, which rose from the main canal like a benevolent behemoth as it blessed not only the manufacturer's pavilion, but also palaces for agriculture, designed by Stanford White, machinery, administration, and electricity. And that was just the Court of Honor. Running perpendicular to the great quadrangle for nearly a mile was yet another opulently lined moat containing most of the other large-scale pavilions and displays, described in one text as a cacophonous confusion of advanced cultures, converted heathens, peculiar tongues, and queer importations. With a fleet of 50 gondolas driven by brand-new electrical engines, visitors could motor to any pavilion they wanted. The electricity pavilion, adorned with a dozen elegant minarets, four of which rose 169 feet above the hall, was over two football fields in length and nearly half that measure in width. Covering 3.5 acres, this spacious and stately structure befitted the seat of the most novel and brilliant exhibit of the Columbian Exposition. The ex-governor of the state of Illinois, William E. Cameron, described the palace as housing the magical achievements of Mr. Edison and his brother wizards. containing the names of the forefathers of the science above a formidable statue of Benjamin Franklin launching his kite at the main vestibule, Electricity Hall presented a fascinating potpourri of advanced technologies. Foremost among the exhibitors were the megalithic corporations such as Westinghouse and GE from America and the more modest-sized AEG from Germany. Whereas AEG reproduced some of the AC equipment Braun and Dobrovolsky used in their epoch-making 108-mile Laufen to Frankfurt transmission, GE presented its own AC system. Westinghouse, having won the bid to light the fair with the only bona fide patents, was in an odd situation. Legally, it should have been able to block the competitors from advertising pirated apparatus, but pragmatically, considering time limitations and other factors, such a tactical action was out of the question. In fact, in some ways, they owed AEG gratitude for pointing the way. Their course was to make it clear that there was only one inventor. And so they erected a 45-foot-high monument in the center aisle of Electricity Hall, which proclaimed the truth to the world. The testimonial read in big bold letters, Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company, Tesla Polyphase System. And with this method, from an annex of Machinery Hall, Westinghouse illuminated the entire World's Fair. Having manufactured 250,000 Sawyer Man stopper lamps for the occasion, Westinghouse generated 3 times more electrical energy than was then being utilized in the entire city of Chicago. Not to be eclipsed, GE constructed a scintillating 82-foot-high tower of light in the exact center of Electricity Hall. It comprised 18,000 lamps running the full length of the pedestal, capped by a single enormous Edison light bulb ignited at the apex. Other features within Electricity Hall included, on the second floor, electrical gadgets to cure all ills, such as charged belts, electrical hairbrushes, and body invigorators, and on the main floor, displays by the most prominent inventors of the day. Elihu Thompson, for instance, unleashed a high-frequency coil that created sparks 5 feet long. Alexander Graham Bell unveiled a telephone that could transmit voice via light beams. And Elisha Gray presented his teleautography machine, a precursor of today's fax machine. For a few cents, it would reproduce a person's signature electronically at a distance. Tom Edison presented his own cornucopia of gadgets, including the multiplex telegraph, the fantastic talking machine known as the phonograph, and his kinetoscope, which for the first time in a public forum displayed the varying labile movements of a human being in motion. Tesla's exhibit, which occupied part of the Westinghouse space, featured a number of his early AC devices, including motors, armatures and generators, phosphorescent signs of noted electricians such as Helmholtz, Faraday, Maxwell, Henry and Franklin, and a sign for his favorite Serbian poet Jovan Šmaj Jovanović. Tesla also displayed vacuum tubes illuminated by means of wireless transmission, his rotating egg of Columbus, sheets of crackling light created by high-frequency discharges between 2 insulated plates, and other neon signs reading Westinghouse and Welcome Electricians. These last 2 displays produced the effect of a modified lightning discharge, accompanied by a similar deafening noise. This was probably one of the most novel attractions, in a sensational way, seen in the building, as the noise could be heard anywhere within Electricity Building, and the flash of the miniature lightning was very brilliant and startling. Tesla traveled to Chicago in August, not only to visit the fair and present a week of demonstrations, but also to attend the International Electrical Congress that was held there for that month. At Electricity Hall, Professor Tesla announces he will send a current of 100,000 volts through his own body without injury to life, an experiment which seems all the more wonderful when we recall the fact that the currents made use of for executing murderers at Sing Sing, New York, have never exceeded 2,000 volts. Mr. Tesla also shows a number of other interesting experiments, some of which are so marvelous as to be almost beyond description. On August the 25th, Nikola Tesla spoke before 1,000 electrical engineers at the International Electrical Congress in Agriculture Hall. In attendance was a galaxy of notables, including Galileo Ferraris, Sir William Preece, Sylvanus Thompson, Elihu Thompson, and honorary chairman Hermann Ludwig von Helmholtz, whom Tesla also took on a tour of his personal exhibit. People crowded about the doors and clamored for admittance. The great majority of those who came with the expectation of seeing Tesla pass a current of 250,000 volts through his body. $10 was offered for a single seat, and offered in vain. Only members of the Electrical Congress with their wives were admitted, and not even they unless they were provided with credentials. Before the lecture, a Chicago reporter inquired of Professors William Preece and Sylvanus Thompson as to the use of the various equipment scattered about the hall, but they gazed in wonder and confessed they could not guess. They simply lumped off the whole lot under the generic term of Tesla's animals. Presently, white-haired Elisha Gray was seen escorting a tall, gaunt young man toward the platform. The young man smiled with pleasure, but modestly kept his eyes on the floor. His cheeks were hollow, his black eyes sunken, but sparkling with animation. Intense and continuous application of his work had sapped his energy, until his friends say he has almost reached the point of dissolution. A gentleman who dined with him a week ago says he could scarcely make himself heard across the table, he was so worn out. He has glossy black hair, parted in the middle, a mustache, heavy under his aquiline nose but fading to a suggestion at the sides of his mouth. His ears are large and stand out from his head. He wore a neat four-button cutaway suit of brownish gray. Gray said to a rousing applause, "I give you the Wizard of Physics, Nikola Tesla." I have, with great reluctance, accepted these compliments, because I had no right to interrupt the flow of speech of our chairman, Tesla began with characteristic humor. Appearing somewhat like a resurrected cadaver, Tesla spoke to allay the fears of all those concerned for his frail health. A number of scientific men urged a group of electricians to deliver a lecture. A great many promised that they would come, but when the program was sifted down, I was the only healthy man left, and so I managed to take some of my apparatus and give you a brief outline of some of my work. Tesla proceeded to display his new steam generators and mechanical oscillators, some of which were so compact that one could readily carry them in the crown of one's hat. He told the audience that his goals were multifaceted. Such a device could, among other things, be used to run motors with perfect synchrony, or electric clocks. He had also produced a continuous wave radio transmitter, although no one at that time understood the complete ramifications of the equipment. Nevertheless, when the resonant frequency was reached, wireless lights would again illuminate, and in that way intelligence was wirelessly transmitted. One of Tesla's more unusual exhibits, which was similar to his Egg of Columbus, was another ring which displayed not only the principles of the rotating magnetic field, but also his theory of planetary motion. In this experiment, one large and several small brass balls were usually employed. When the field was energized, all the balls would be set spinning, the large ones remaining in the center, while the small ones revolved around it like moons about a planet, gradually receding until they reached the outer guard and raced along the same. But the demonstration which most impressed the audiences was the simultaneous operation of numerous balls, pivoted discs, and other devices placed in all sorts of positions and at considerable distances from the rotating field. When the currents were turned on, and the whole animated with motion, it presented an unforgettable spectacle. Mr. Tesla had many vacuum bulbs, in which small, light metal discs were pivotally arranged on jewels, and these would spin anywhere in the hall when the iron ring was energized. Tesla returned to New York, exhausted, but exhilarated.
13. The Filipovs, 1894.
Mr. Tesla has been held a visionary, deceived by the flash of casual shooting stars, but the growing conviction of his professional brethren is that because he saw farther, he saw first the low lights flickering on the tangible new continents of science. The perceptive and imaginative qualities of the mind are not often equally marked in the same man of genius.
T.C. Martin. Fame had arrived, and at all levels. In engineering circles, Tesla was known as one of the most remarkable discoverers of the age. To the magazines as, heaven forbid, the new Edison. To the newspapers as our foremost electrician. To the masses as a wondrous wizard from a strange land. And to the financiers as bankable. Having recognized the virtuoso from the outset, T.C. Martin, as head trumpeter, was now helping choreograph Tesla's vault into the public arena. Comerford, as he was known to his friends, had generated a propitious relationship to all concerned when he met with Robert Underwood Johnson, associate editor of The Century, to propose a feature article on the thriving electronic savant. "Take a seat," Johnson offered as he scanned through toppling stacks of manuscripts scattered about the office to find a chair that could be easily cleared. A brother of a congressman and a poet, Johnson had in 1889 been honored by the city when he was chosen to contribute an original sonnet for the unveiling of the Washington Square Arch, which he read before President Harrison and other dignitaries. A temporary structure designed by Stanford White, commemorating 100 years since the inauguration of George Washington, this arch predated by a few years the permanent marble arch also designed by White. Johnson was also knowledgeable about inventors, having visited Edison's laboratory in the early 1880s as a reporter for Scribner's Monthly, the precursor of the Century. Tesla, no doubt, had already piqued his interest. Impressed with the eloquent portrait Martin had painted of Tesla, Johnson invited his colleague over for dinner. "Why not bring the wizard along? Perhaps there is more than one article here for the offing." On a first-name basis with such personalities as mayoral candidate Theodore Roosevelt and writer Mark Twain, two frequent visitors to his Union Square office, Johnson and his ebullient wife Catherine were the very essence of the phrase gracious hosts. Through their dinner parties at their home at 327 Lexington Avenue, a visitor could dine with any number of luminaries, such as sculptor Auguste Saint-Gaudens, actress Eleonora Duse, poet and editor-in-chief of The Century Richard Watson Gilder, naturalist John Muir, activist for children's rights Mary Mapes Dodge, conductor of the Boston Symphony Monsieur Gericke, composer and pianist Ignacy Paderewski, thespian Joseph Jefferson, or writer extraordinaire Rudyard Kipling. Johnson had just returned with his wife from their second trip to Europe, where they had, by chance, run into Twain in Venice. The world was a cozy and romantic place for the Johnsons, in part because they found it that way, and in part because they molded it that way. Martin arrived with a pallid, drawn, and haggard Tesla at the Johnson home in the middle of the Christmas season. They were greeted by Catherine and Robert Johnson and their two children, Agnes, who was about 16, and Owen, who was 2 or 3 years younger. The inventor's frail condition, which one reporter described as having reached the limits of human endurance, took the Johnsons, especially Catherine, by surprise. A facile conversationalist, Catherine was a striking woman of Irish descent, poised with shoulders swept back, her head held erect. Although her hair was now beginning to streak grey, she still exuded an air of youth. It was her eyes in particular that visitors were drawn to. Slightly coquettish, they displayed a daring sense of play beneath a wistful stare. Triggering a constellation of emotions, ranging from maternal instincts to beguilement, Catherine became enthralled, some would say mesmerized, by the Serbian superman who had entered her world. And he had taken to her. Tesla talked about his European tour, particularly his meeting with Sir William Crookes, and the Johnsons invited him for Christmas. "You are overworked, Mr. Tesla, and you should take a holiday," Catherine declared. "Perhaps a good Christmas meal will keep you going through the first months of the new year." "I get all the nourishment I require from my laboratory," Tesla retorted. "I know I am completely worn out, and yet I cannot stop my work. These experiments of mine are so important, so beautiful, so fascinating, that I can hardly tear myself away from them to eat, and when I try to sleep, I think about them constantly. I expect I shall go on until I break down altogether. Come, let us go there for our dessert." A carriage was called, and in short order, the Johnsons were lured to the magician's den. "Be prepared for a surprise or two," Tesla said, as he, in the words of a reporter who experienced a similar episode, ushered them into a room some 25 feet square, lighted on one side by 2 broad windows, partially covered by heavy black curtains. The laboratory was literally filled with curious mechanical appliances of every description. Snake-like cables ran along the walls, ceiling, and floor. In the center was an electric dynamo, which sat upon a large circular table covered with thick strips of black woolen cloth. 2 large brownish globes, 18 inches in diameter, were suspended from the ceiling by cords. Composed of brass, coated and insulated with wax, these globes served the purpose of spreading the electrostatic field. Tesla shut the doors and drew the curtains, until every chink or crevice for the admission of light was concealed, and the laboratory bathed in absolutely impenetrable gloom. As we awaited developments, exquisitely beautiful luminous signs and devices of mystic origin began to flash about. Sometimes they seemed iridescent, the entire room filled with electric vibrations, as tubes and bulbs, which we held, became luminous. What impressed us most of all, perhaps, was the simple but cheerful fact that we remained unscathed while electrical bombardments were taking place on every side. A few days later, in honor of the celebration of the Serbian Christmas on January the 6th, Catherine sent Tesla a bouquet. "I have to thank Mrs. Johnson for the magnificent flowers," Tesla wrote Robert. "I have never received flowers before, and they produced upon me a curious effect." Tesla would return to the Johnson home on a regular basis for dinner, or after an evening on his own for a late nightcap, and the inventor reciprocated by taking the Johnsons out on the town. They would be attending the gala performance of Dvorak's New World Symphony. "Upon receipt of your first note," Tesla wrote Robert, "I immediately secured the best seats I could for Saturday. Nothing better than the 15th row. Very sorry, we shall have to use telescopes, but I think the better for Mrs. Johnson's vivid imagination. Dinner at Delmonico's." Intrigued with Tesla's fascinating heritage, Robert became interested in Serbian poetry, and so Tesla began to translate for him. They obtained permission from Shmaj Jovanovich to feature some of his poems for inclusion in the Century, and also in a book Johnson entitled Songs of Liberty. Their favorite was undoubtedly the ballad about a warrior from a Montenegrin battle, which took place in 1874. Luka Filipov. "One more hero to be part of the Servians' glory. Lute to lute and heart to heart, tell the homely story. Let the Muslim hide for shame, trembling like the falcon's game, thinking on the falcon's name, Luka Filipov." The verse goes on to describe a fierce battle in which Luka captures a pasha and marches him back to the prince. However, on the way, Luka becomes wounded in an ambush, so his soldiers decide to retaliate by killing the arrested Turk. "We'd have fired, but Luka's hand rose in protestation, while his pistol's mute command needed no translation. For the Turk retraced his track, knelt and took upon his back, as a peddler lifts his pack, Luka Filipov. How we cheered him as he passed through the line, a swinging gun and pistol, bleeding fast, grim but loudly singing. But as couriers came to say that our friends had won the day, who should up and faint away? Luka Filipov." One can easily envision Robert's and Catherine's eyes aglow as Tesla spontaneously translated Schmai's ode in their living room one special evening, and how Robert worked to hone it for publication. From this moment on, brother Robert would be known as Dear Luka, and Catherine would be addressed as Mrs. Filipov. To Catherine, Tesla was more than a man. He was an icon of historical importance, a trophy to display before her lady friends, and even more than this, he was a tangible symbol of intangible longings. In her essence, Catherine was a frustrated artist whose ever-present yearnings pulled her from moments of exaltation to the edge of despair. She must have been a difficult person to live with, but like Tesla, she had the capability to spark that realm that makes life all the more worth living. Selfish, egocentric, and histrionic at times, Catherine also had a dominant streak that not only pulled people to her, but manipulated them to her needs. Even the elusive hermit became a fly in her web. "Dear Mr. Tesla," she wrote in January 1894,
We have had a hospital here since Thursday. Robert and Agnes, the invalids. Robert is better, but not out, and we want you to come this evening and brighten us up. As a great favor, come to us immediately.
This beckoning to her auxiliary mate became a recurrent theme that replayed itself again and again through the next many years. For instance, in 1896, she wrote,
"Dear Mr. Tesla, I shall expect to see you tomorrow evening."
In 1897,
"Come soon."
And in 1898,
"Will you come and see me tomorrow evening, and will you try to come a little early? I want very much to see you, and will be really disappointed if you do not think my request worthy of your consideration."
But Catherine was not alone in her infatuation. T.C. Martin had discovered him, but Robert would soon become Tesla's closest confidant. A triad of intimacy quickly transpired as Comerford Martin's hold on the inventor began to loosen. And just as much as the Johnsons would come to cherish Tesla, he would cherish them. Here was a loving family the isolate could bind to. Tesla's health constantly was an issue not only for their own concerns, but also for the good of the species. Martin, whose new article in the Century would certainly serve to advance his own career as well as Tesla's, was just as solicitous, and he discussed the precariousness of the situation with Catherine. "I do not believe that he will give up work at any very early date," Martin wrote. Talking of California with him in a casual way elicited the fact that he had had a couple of invitations to lecture there, so that I don't want to jam his head into that lion's mouth. "I believe he is going to take more care of himself, and you may have done us all a great deal of service by your timely words." "Yet in spite of that," Martin continued, "I fear he will go on in the delusion that woman is generically a Delilah who would shear him of his locks. If you can manage it, I believe it would be a good scheme to have that doctor get hold of him. My prescription is a weekly lecture from Mrs. R.U.J. This passage by a Tesla colleague is a rare glimpse at one of the enduring mysteries about Tesla, namely his supposed celibacy and mysterious sexual inclinations. By coincidence, only a fortnight later, Heinrich Hertz was dead. He was only 36. Martin wrote to Tesla, "For God's sake, let it be a warning to you. All Europe mourns for such an untimely taking off." But Tesla would take no heed, and his custom of driving himself to the limit would be a style of living that he would continue for many years. The future of the race and his role in it was clear to him. Nothing could stand in his way. "The time will come," Tesla told Catherine, "when crossing the ocean by steamer, you will be able to have a daily newspaper on board with the important news of the world, and when by means of a pocket instrument and a wire stuck in the ground, you can communicate from any distance with friends at home through an instrument similarly attuned." His gaze and seeming powers of divination took her breath away. Penetrating his inner sanctum only added to her captivation. At the outset, Tesla's unparalleled achievements, explosion into international stardom, and promise for the future generated an express desire for all to cash in, to sell his multitudinous array of inventions so that they could ascend together to the next social rung. Their goal was to become millionaires. Tesla's cold light appeared to be the first ticket. As Martin's erudite biographical essay had received words of praise even from competitors, Johnson suggested that they plan a second piece, one that featured the lab. Johnson would get some of his more famous friends to come, and photos would be taken. This would be an exclusive, the first ever with the new revolutionary cold light. Johnson writes, "We were frequently invited to witness his experiments, which included the production of electrical vibrations of an intensity not before achieved. Lightning-like flashes of the length of 15 feet were an everyday occurrence, and his tubes of electric light were used to make photographs of many of his friends as souvenir of their visits. He was the first person to make use of phosphorescent light for photographic purposes, not a small item of invention in itself. I was one of a group consisting of Mark Twain, Joseph Jefferson, Marion Crawford, and others who had the unique experience of being thus photographed." Naturally, the Twain pictures would become the centerpiece. S.L. Clemens, as he signed his letters to Tesla,
came to the laboratory on March the 4th, 1894, and again on April the 26th. Twain wrote to postpone the initial meeting for